Origins and Persecution, the first talk in a series on church history, was presented by Peter Wieringa on March 22, 2009, at Reformation Fellowship. The first 10 minutes of this recording have been lost. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
At different times in church history also, we see that truth is set aside when there's a different goal, whether it's political harmony, whether it's harmony within an organization. Truth is often sacrificed when the bigger goal is to get everyone organized and moving in the same direction to develop a consensus. So those are the things that, just so you know them, those are some of the things that give some background to what I'm thinking about and what I'm processing as I work through church history. Bigger than that, though, more than that, though, the church history is a history of a fallen people who are struggling with trying to understand what it is that God has communicated and who it is that he has called us to be. That's sort of, in a nutshell, when we're looking at church history, what we're studying. Now, as part of that, we'll end up talking about people and places and movements and theological controversies, and we'll talk about all those things, but at the very most fundamental level, it's the struggle of people to understand who God is and what it is he's called us to do, who it is he's called us to be. And we see that not just in church history, but we really see the stage for that being set in the Old Testament. And there we have the narrative, the authoritative narrative, if you will, of the history of the community that God had called together. We see that written out there, and we see what a struggle they had. How could we think, as the church, as the church after Jesus came, how could we think that we wouldn't struggle with truth and that we wouldn't struggle with sometimes going a different direction when we see in the Old Testament such a clear history of the Jews during that time? There will be times that they in a significant way are following God and are seeking to know what who he is and what he has in mind for them. And then there are times that they absolutely get completely off track. That's the account of the Old Testament. We see that particularly in the prophets in the later part of the Old Testament, where God is constantly calling them to repentance, constantly calling them back to what he had called them to in the first place. So if that's the history of the Old Testament, why would we think, as a church, why would we think that we have since then necessarily gotten it right? When I first, when I was younger, when I was in college, high school, college, that sort of thing, and I was becoming interested in church history, I thought it was incumbent upon me to defend every aspect of what had gone on in the church. I thought, if it happened in the church, if this is what Christians were doing, then it must have been okay. Well, that isn't the case. There were lots of times throughout the history of the church that the church got off track in significant ways. There are also lots of times where the truth of the gospel and the truth of who God is were clearly articulated, at least in certain aspects, clearly articulated and aggressively followed by many, many people. So the history of the church is just a fascinating story, because you see people's strengths, people's weaknesses, you see the rise and fall of movements, the rise and fall of denominations, the rise and fall of individuals. You just see this fascinating story, this mural of ongoing church history, where you see the ebb and flow of people understanding, coming to grips with, grasping what is right and what is true, then losing track and getting off track. What is, I think, the underlying theme to the whole thing is that God has always been faithful to maintain for himself a community of individuals who are faithful to what is true. That was true throughout the Old Testament. That was true. That's been true ever since the church began as well. God has always maintained for himself a faithful remnant, if you will, of people who know him and follow him. Well, let me just jump in a little bit with some dates. I love dates. I was the guy, actually when I was in high school, I couldn't stand history. But once I got into college, I was the guy that just loved history, loved to memorize the dates, the individuals, all that sort of thing. For me, dates are primarily just to give me places to hang my thoughts on, just to give me ways to be able to put together sort of a line of thought and a development of thought and that sort of thing. So let me just start off with giving you some dates, and I'm going to give you the big context here. Starting with, and this is just to give you some historical perspective, starting with Abraham, and we're just going to go over this very briefly, but Abraham lived somewhere around 2000 BC. I was going to try to actually give you the date that God created the heavens and the earth, but I couldn't quite come up with that one. So we're going to start with a date that's more knowable. Abraham was right around 2000 BC. The bondage in Egypt, the period where the Israelites were in bondage in Egypt was roughly around 1680 to 1280 BC. Moses lived around 1360 BC. David was king around 1000 BC. And then we get down much closer to New Testament times. The Babylonian captivity was around 600 BC. The last book of the Old Testament was written around 425 BC. So that just gives you some long-term perspective. And then we don't have any Old Testament account to speak of. We don't have a narrative of what was going on with the Jews in the Old Testament. We don't have any other books, Old Testament books, that were written after about 425 BC. So when we get to the beginning of the church with Jesus in the first century AD, when we get to that period of time, we've got some lapses in the background. We don't have as much history as to just exactly what led up to the time of Jesus. But we do know a couple things about. Now I wanted to talk just a little bit about Palestine in the first century here to give you some context. This is even some of these things are still being discussed, and we're still trying to sort things out. For example, when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered back about 60 years ago, that gave us a whole new light, a whole different, slightly different perspective on what was going on in Palestine in the first century. So there are different. We're still getting more information from time to time. But just let me just give you a look from 30,000 feet, so to speak. In Palestine in the first century, the Pharisees were the dominant religious party in Palestine. Now, for us, if we grew up going to Sunday school all of our lives, that sort of thing, the Pharisees are the villains, if you will, in many respects, when we think about our own background growing up in the church. But for the Jews in Palestine in the first century, the Pharisees, in many respects, were the party of the people, the religious party of the people, if you will. The Sadducees were the ones who were most tightly tied to the temple. The Pharisees were the ones who were much more out amongst the people. The Pharisees were the ones that were involved on a much more local level. We can see from the New Testament and from other records, the Pharisees in many respects didn't have it right theologically, but we think of them usually as lording it over the people for the sake of lording it over the people, and that wasn't the case. They were committed to trying to rejuvenate Judaism at that time. And to do that, and this goes along with the theme that I mentioned earlier, to do that, part of doing that was to get everything systematized and get things reduced to a manageable level, so that so that that true Judaism could be spread out amongst the people. Well, Phariseeism was the dominant party. In terms of the very early period of the church, we see that, and we don't know exactly what Jesus' birth date, what year he was born, what year he was crucified, but somewhere in the first three decades of AD was when Jesus was crucified, and soon after that we see the church beginning to expand. But in terms of Judaism, the Jews were scattered to a very large degree in 70 AD when the Romans were quelling an insurrection in Palestine and when they destroyed the temple, and it was at that point that the Jews, to a very large degree, scattered around the world. Now, prior to that time, the church had begun to expand beyond Jerusalem, but Judaism, as it was identified specifically and primarily with Palestine, that changed dramatically with the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. But in terms of what was important about Judaism, let me just mention a couple of things. Judaism was the first great religion that understood and taught and propagated the idea of monotheism. I think it was David in a sermon just a couple weeks ago that said something that helped me to think things through. Prior to the Babylonian captivity, even the Jews struggled with monotheism. Even the Jews at that point were bringing in other gods and were following other gods and were open to things like that. But with the Babylonian captivity, once they came back from the captivity, they seemed to have really settled on this idea of monotheism. There is one God only. And that became a hallmark of Judaism in contrast to much of what was going on in the cultures around them. So monotheism was one of the main things that characterized Judaism in the first century, as well as a hope, an eschatological hope. They had this hope that had been propagated throughout their history that we see throughout the Old Testament. They had this hope that they were looking forward to, that God was going to intervene in a very significant way. They were looking for the Messiah. So when we look at church history, we find that in that first century there, one of the biggest struggles that they were going to have, one of the biggest issues they had to deal with, was this question of, who is Jesus? Is Jesus the one that they were expecting? Is he the one they were looking forward to? Did he fit the description that they were looking for? Who is he? And who is he in some very significant ways? And this gets into the struggles we'll talk more about next week with regard to the doctrinal struggles that went on in the history of the church. Specifically, narrowly, who is Jesus? I mean, what is this business about God becoming a man? This defies rationality in some respects, and it was this struggle that they had to come to grips with that and to try to fine-tune exactly what they meant. But for Jews, they had this belief in one God, and they had this hope that God was going to intervene in human history to begin to set things right. That's the context that we have when Jesus comes along. Now, for the church, what was very difficult for the church is that in the Roman Empire during this time, the Roman Empire encouraged syncretism. The Roman Empire encouraged, because the Roman Empire was so vast and covered so many different cultures and people with different belief systems, what they did was they encouraged people to adhere to their own beliefs as long as they didn't come into conflict with the greater good of the unity of the Roman Empire. And we'll see here in a little bit this morning, that's where the church got into trouble. That's where the Jews got into trouble. Because the Christians in the church and the Jews both put their allegiance to God above their allegiance to the empire. And that's where eventually they got into trouble. But for the Roman Empire, there was an encouragement for people to be able to maintain their own belief system as much as possible. In the Roman Empire, there was tremendous commerce. There was tremendous. There were opportunities for travel, that sort of thing that set the stage, if you will, for the spread of the gospel, for the spread of the church once the first century was well underway. Let's talk a little bit about the church in the first century, the church in the New Testament. Initially, the church was, in many respects, seen as a sect of Judaism. It was seen as just sort of an offshoot of Judaism in many respects. there were, obviously, because the church grew out of the Old Testament, grew out of what God had been doing throughout human history, was just a continuation of what he was doing. That's a logical thing. And there are clearly, obviously, there is a continuity between who we are as a church and what God was doing throughout the Old Testament. But where they began to get into conflict over time was with those distinctives, with those things that were a little bit different. When Jesus in the Gospels would confront the Pharisees, well, that was a confrontation with what was the accepted form of Judaism at that time. And when people had to struggle with, is this Jesus? Is he the Messiah that they're expecting? He doesn't look like the Messiah that they're expecting. He doesn't seem to act like it. He hasn't taken the reins of power as they had thought that he would. Is this, in fact, the Messiah that they're expecting? And then even more critically, when Jesus characterized himself, allowed himself and characterized himself as God, what are the Jews going to do with that? I mean, stop and think about it, if you can. Put yourself in the situation of a New Testament Jew. What are the Jews going to do about that? Because for them, monotheism, the idea that there is one God, was such a critical part of their understanding, rightly, understandably, it was such a critical part of their understanding. Well, what do they do then? How do they understand who Jesus is when they have this long-held belief in monotheism? So those are the struggles that they were going through, the early church was going through, as it was trying to come to grips with where it fit into Judaism, and the Jews were trying to come to grips with where the Christians fit in. But basically, in many respects, Jesus was just not exactly what they expected, not exactly what they were looking for. Let's just talk a little bit about the church in Acts. If you want to see if you want to understand the early stages of church history, the early parts of church history, you read the Gospels, and you read the book of Acts, and you read the rest of the New Testament, because there you get a sense of what the early growth of the church was all about, what some of their struggles were all about, what things they were wrestling with. You get a picture of those things in the New Testament itself. Church began with very, very small beginnings, 120 people scared, gathered together in the upper room in Jerusalem. Jesus had been crucified at that point and had been resurrected already, and they recognized that Jesus' teaching was not popular. So there's this small group of people that are gathered together and trying to figure out exactly what they're going to do. In that context, we see the day of Pentecost, which is, again, you read that, and that is just an unbelievable account. When you see what God is doing, even in that context, to begin to reach out beyond Palestine, you have Jews from all over the world who have gathered to Jerusalem, and when they begin to hear the gospel being taught in languages that they understood, what a phenomenal indication that God was giving to them of his plans for the truth to go and to reach far beyond just Palestine and just Jerusalem at that time. But the church is still trying to figure out exactly what they're called to do. Jesus told them when he was ascended, he says, okay, now I want you to go out to all the people. I want you to go out to the uttermost parts of the earth and to teach and to preach and to baptize. So he tells them he wants them to go out But what they do is they stay home. He tells them that his intention for them is to go out beyond their city, their geographic area, and to teach and to preach. But for the most part, they still remain sort of huddled together and trying to figure out there in Jerusalem who they are, until in Acts 8, until we see Stephen being stoned. And at that point, and this is one thing that's just fascinating about the history of the church, how often persecution accompanied the growth of the church. And this is a theme that I had mentioned earlier. It's just fascinating how often persecution forced people, in this case, it forced Christians outside of their geographic area and sent them into nearby communities and to nearby cities, that sort of thing. It sent them beyond their geographic area, but it also required then that people would wrestle with whether or not they really believed the truth of what they say they believed in, because now there's a cost. And when that happens, when people are forced to make that sort of decision or forced to decide, is it worth my life? Is it worth the loss of my possessions? Is it worth the life of my family to believe this? That's when you see people who really take seriously what it is they believe. And that's what was going on in the church in the first century there. But you have this huge struggle that we see throughout the New Testament, and we see this particularly in some of the letters that Paul wrote, but also in the book of Acts. You have this huge struggle because all of a sudden they get outside Jerusalem and they go into nearby countries and nearby areas and cities, and all of a sudden they have the opportunity to preach the gospel to Gentiles. And for the church in the New Testament, that was a huge struggle. That was just a massive struggle, because the Jews, prior to Jesus coming, I should have mentioned this a minute ago, prior to Jesus coming, part of the consolidation, if you will, in a sense of Judaism in the centuries before Jesus coming, was, again, this affirmed belief in monotheism, but it was also there was also a sort of an isolation that the Jews created for themselves. They were different from the cultures around them. They did things differently. They thought of things differently. They believed different things. And there was an increasing isolation prior to Jesus coming. And then when Jesus comes, he breaks out of that isolation. You see that somewhat in the gospel accounts when Jesus interacts with Gentiles, and you see some of his interaction there and how surprising that was to his disciples at the time. But then beyond that, you see Jesus telling them to go out and to preach to other peoples. And so as the gospel goes out to other peoples and goes out to the Gentiles, again, we can't understand that because we are the Gentiles. But for the Jews at that time, what a shock it was. How uncharacteristic in their minds for that to happen, because that's gonna ruin the purity. That's gonna get things all confused if it goes out to the Gentiles. That was a very confusing thing for them to try to figure out how that fit in. And you see that struggle in the New Testament as well, particularly in a letter like Galatians. You see that battle that was going on with, okay, what do we do? Are we Jews first and then Christians, or are we Christians and that supersedes being Jews? How does all this fit together? So those are the sorts of struggles that were going on in the church in the first century. Well, just a little bit of quick chronology of the New Testament. Jesus was crucified somewhere around 30 AD. We don't know the exact date of when he was crucified. Paul was converted most likely within a few very short years of that time, soon after his crucifixion. Paul's first missionary journey was probably in the mid-40s AD. Peter and Paul ended up both being martyred separately in Rome in somewhere in the 60s. We have different dates, 63, 65 AD, different accounts of just when it happened, but somewhere in the 60s, Peter and Paul had both found their way all the way to Rome, and that just gives you a little bit of a picture of how far the gospel had spread by that time. And as you're reading through your New Testament, it'd be a good exercise for you to take each of the letters, for example, in the New Testament, and take a note of the geographic locations that are mentioned in there, and then just look at your map on the back of your Bible and see where those places are. And you'll see how quickly, within 20, 30 years of Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection, you'll see how quickly the gospel was spreading around the Roman Empire. It was spreading like wildfire in many respects in those first three decades. So mid-60s was when Peter and Paul were martyred. The temple was destroyed in Jerusalem in 70 AD, and that's when there was the diaspora. The Jews were dispersed into other countries as well. Most of the New Testament writings were written then in probably the 50s, 60s, 70s. And the last New Testament writing, it's hard to tell. I don't know exactly when John died. He might very well have lived into the early part of the second century before he finished his writing. So you'll see that the second half of the first century is when the New Testament writings were all completed for people to read and for people to have those accounts of the Gospels and those copies of those letters that Peter and Paul and others had written. So that's all going on in the first century. But then now let me go back to a different theme, and this is going to be what I'm going to talk about for just a few minutes, and then we're going to today I'm going to talk about persecution within the church, and then next week we'll talk some more about some of the battle of ideas and the theological controversies that were going on in the first 300 years of the church. But with regard to persecution in the church, we see it beginning early on. We see very early, obviously with Jesus himself, we see the prevailing religious sentiment of the time being opposed to what Jesus was teaching, and Jesus then obviously was crucified. What's most obviously is that he was crucified because that was God's plan, but in terms of what we see in the New Testament there, Jesus and his teaching were opposed all along the way by the Pharisees, and he ended up being crucified for what he was teaching. Then beyond that, in the book of Acts, we see other persecution. We see ongoing persecution. It shouldn't be a surprise to us that that's what happens when truth confronts the prevailing culture of the time. But we see persecution going on. Peter and John were arrested within just a few short months of Jesus' resurrection in Acts 4. We see them arrested, and we see the account of what went on with Peter and John. We see Peter and John proclaiming very clearly, very overtly, that even as they're told not to talk about Jesus anymore, not to preach Jesus, they proclaim very clearly, you know, if I've got to answer to somebody, I'm going to answer to God, and so I can't not preach Jesus. Peter and John, even in that case, took a stand against the prevailing culture that was trying to force them to change what they were saying and what they were doing. Soon after that, in Acts 5, we see the Sadducees laid hands on the apostles and put them in a public jail. The angel released them in the account in Acts 5, verses 17 through 20. And let me just read to you Gamaliel, who was one of the religious leaders of the time, read to you what he had to say, because his words were absolutely right with what he had to say at that time. Gamaliel said to the other religious leaders, he said, "Take care what you propose to do with these men. Stay away from these men." He's talking about the apostles here. "Stay away from these men and let them alone. For if this plan or action, their activities, if this plan or action should be of men, it will be overthrown. But if it is of God, you will not be able to overthrow it, or else you may even be found fighting against God." That's Acts 5, verses 33 to 39, that passage in there. And that sets the stage for all of church history. If it's of God, it will not be stopped. It could not be stopped. It was not stopped. But if it's of men, there's a rise and fall. There's an ebb and flow. There are times that that movements and that ideas gain a lot of weight, and then there are times that that those things pass away. But those were Gamaliel's words. Soon after that was when Stephen was stoned. The church was scattered. We find that the Roman authorities were often in conflict with the Christians during that time, and the Christians began to fear. In that context also, we see what Paul was doing. In the account in Acts, we see that Paul asked permission of the religious leaders to go into surrounding communities and find those who identify themselves as being of the way, those who identify themselves as being Christians. He asked to go out to find those people in order to persecute those people. And it was along the way then that that Paul was on his way to Damascus that he was converted, that he himself became a believer. But we see active persecution going on the part of the Jews during that time. But that was small potatoes compared to what was going to go on with the Romans in the first 300 years of the church. Initially, persecution within the church, or persecution of the church, rather, within the Roman Empire. Initially, it was sort of sporadic, not very well coordinated, not very well organized. It was sort of persecution in the Roman Empire initially had to do much more with what was going on in local areas. If a local authority saw fit to persecute the church for whatever reason, or if Christians were called to his attention, there might be some local persecutions, but there was not a widespread, empire-wide persecution going on initially anyway. But here's the problem for the Christians during this time in the early years. Here's the main problem, and that is the Christians, just like the Jews, gave ultimate allegiance to God alone. And for the Romans, if you've studied Roman history, for the Romans, ultimate allegiance was to the state and to the emperor. Those things were of primary importance for a Roman citizen, and everything else was to be subordinated to allegiance to the state and to the emperor. Well, you can see how immediately with that the Christians would run afoul of the local authorities, because they would not give that sort of ultimate allegiance to the state and to the emperor. So we see that going on. We see all sorts of confusion about what the church was all about. When you have Christians gather together and celebrate the Lord's Supper together, celebrate communion together, and they gather and talk about eating the body and drinking the blood, taking their words simply from the pictures that we have in the New Testament. When word gets out about people talking about those sorts of things, then rumors begin to run rampant about what's going on when Christians get together. Talk of sacrifice leads to questions about human sacrifice. Talks of partaking of the body and the blood result in talks about cannibalism. I mean, it's amazing the rumors that began to spread about what Christians really believed and what they were doing. So there were times that Christians would have run afoul of the local governing authority, and there would be some persecution as a result of that. There were times that Christians would run afoul of their neighbors who didn't understand what they were doing and didn't see clearly what was going on, and they would oppose the Christians. So we began to see early on there some sporadic persecutions around the empire. Generally speaking, in the empire there was sort of a don't ask, don't tell sort of policy with regard to Christianity. If the Christians just didn't get in anybody's hair, didn't cross anybody, weren't too overt, then generally speaking, they were left alone. But it was when they somehow or other ran afoul of someone else, the neighbors, the authorities, something like that, that was when they began to experience some persecution in those early years. Christians were, in some respects, made scapegoats for things, and the most obvious account of that is the account that most of us are probably familiar with, the account of Nero, the emperor in Rome, who, when the great fire swept through Rome, there was a huge fire that destroyed huge parts of the city. There had already been tremendous social unrest. There had already been food shortages. There had already been problems. When the fire swept through Rome, Nero was not above seizing on that to blame the Christians and say, see, the reason this is happening, one of his scapegoats, the reason this is happening is because these Christians don't follow the same belief system that we do. And it's because these Christians are doing this and they're here among us, that's the reason why the gods have frowned upon the Roman Empire, and that's the reason for the fire. So there were times that scapegoating went on with regard to the Christians being blamed for things that they had absolutely nothing to do with. Lots of confusion about the church. I've talked about that. There was martyrdom that was going on. We see martyrdom in the New Testament with Stephen, and we see other accounts of martyrdom in the New Testament. We see that then beginning to spread throughout the empire. And what happens is the Emperor Domitian in 81 AD was beginning then to in a more determined way, in a more organized way, to spread persecution of Christians around the empire. Well, let me talk just a little bit about martyrdom, because martyrdom in the early years of the church, martyrdom was a real difficult issue for them to come to grips with, because for some people, they were asked to make a choice between whether or not they were going to believe the gospel and proclaim their allegiance to the gospel and to God, or whether they're going to proclaim their allegiance to the state. And for some, they were asked to do that on pain of death. So then there's this struggle, and I'm going to talk about a little bit more later on. There's this struggle about, so what do you do about martyrdom? In some cases, people sought to avoid martyrdom. In other cases, there were some believers, some Christians who embraced martyrdom. And you see there, at least for me, when I think about that, I try to think through, I wonder what those folks were thinking on both sides of the issue. I mean, what were people thinking? How were they processing exactly what God was doing? Like I said, there were some cases in which believers walked into and welcomed martyrdom as a sign of their faithfulness. Well, was that the right thing to do or not? I don't know. I don't have any sort of a final judgment on that. But those were some of the struggles that were going on in the church in the early years there, struggles with how exactly do they live out their life as believers in that context and in that social setting and in that political setting. Well, let me talk about persecutions a little bit, about how widespread they became, and then I'm going to make just a closing comment or two and read something to you from a book, and then we'll open it up for questions. But the persecutions toward the end of the first century began to become more planned, more systematic. Marcus Aurelius was supposedly a more enlightened empire. He was known as a more educated emperor, rather. He was known as a more educated emperor, but he spread persecutions throughout the empire on a very large scale. And we see some very prominent church fathers who, in fact, were martyred under Marcus Aurelius. Polycarp was, Justin Martyr was, thus the name, were both martyred under Marcus Aurelius. So we see then martyrdom becoming much more widespread. And it was in part, in many respects, largely because Marcus Aurelius was intent on maintaining the unity of the empire. You see, by the time Marcus Aurelius was around, around 162 AD, the empire was really struggling at that point. It was being tested from the outside in. It was being tested from the inside out. Again, a lot of social unrest, upheaval. There were the barbarians were beginning to knock on the door, and so you see a testing of the empire. And what Marcus Aurelius was trying to do was to keep the empire unified, and to do that, he had to squelch Christianity, which gave their allegiance to something, someone, other than the empire. So we see that going on with Marcus Aurelius. Interestingly enough, we see, this is a little bit later here, we see in 247 AD, we see Rome celebrating the 1,000-year anniversary of the establishment of Rome. So they're going back to their accounts of when Rome was first established, and 1,000 years later, they're celebrating 1,000-year anniversary of the establishment of Rome, and 1 year later is when the Gothic invasions of the empire began. So there's all this tremendous turmoil going on in these years in the Roman Empire, and the emperors are trying to figure out how to keep the empire unified in the midst of that. We have in 249 to 251, 251 to 253, we have two other emperors, Decius and Gallus, who declared that everyone must sacrifice to the old Roman gods and get what was called a libelus, basically a certificate of proof that they had sacrificed to the gods. So there was this systematic way of making everyone who lived within the Roman Empire, making everyone show their allegiance to the Roman gods by sacrificing to the gods and receiving a certificate. So now the church is forced to struggle with just exactly what do they do about that? How do they handle that? Valerian in 253 to 260 redoubled the persecution. Diocletian, 284 to 305, reorganized the empire, and he expanded the persecution as well. He demanded full loyalty from the Christians in every respect. He ordered that their churches be destroyed. He ordered that their Bibles and their liturgies be surrendered. Their worship was forbidden. So you can see by the end of the third century there, you can see that persecution had spread throughout the empire, targeting the Christians, specifically martyring, specifically killing the clergy of the churches, the leaders of the churches, the pastors in those days, and persecution has then spread throughout the empire. Well, I just wanted to mention one struggle that they had, and this has to do with how do they figure out how to live in this context? Because as you can imagine, they're ordered to sacrifice to the Roman gods, they get this certificate, and different people handled that differently. Some people refused to sacrifice to the Roman gods and were killed. Some people sacrificed to the Roman gods with their fingers crossed, got the certificate, and then they lived, and then they came back to the church, and the church had to figure out, well, what do we do with them? I mean, they have publicly proclaimed that they're willing to sacrifice to the Roman gods. What do we do with them? Are they really believers? Are they not? And there were these struggles that were going on during this time that the church had to try to figure out how to deal with, and it became a huge issue throughout the churches in the Roman Empire, with this huge question of, there were other people who perhaps turned away from their belief while persecution was going on, and then when persecution ended, they would try to come back to the church. There were some who turned away from their belief while persecution was going on and then came back during the persecution. And I mean, there were these internal struggles that people were having and these different ways of doing things, and the church had to figure out how to deal with them. And that's part of where, that's where the seeds of some of the confusion that we see later on in the Middle Ages in the church, that's part of where some of those seeds were sown, because the church struggled with, okay, how do we determine whether or not those people truly are believers or not? What do we do with those people? What sort of requirements are we going to place on those who want to come back into the church? What are the requirements to allow them to be readmitted into the church? And it was that whole question, that whole idea that led to the church beginning to lay out requirements, external requirements, that would determine whether or not one was truly a believer and should be within the church. It was during that time that the idea that you had to be in the church, formally recognized as being in the church, you had to be in the church in order to be saved, that idea was coming up during this time. And then, if that's what you believe, how do you decide who's in the church or not? Well, the best way to do that is to lay out certain things that one has to do in order to be a Christian in good standing in the church. So we see the very beginning stages there of the penitential system, part of the sacramental system of the church in the Middle Ages. We see the beginning stages there of that sort of thing, where if you are lapsed, if you've turned away from the church, if you've fallen away, well, then if you do these things, then we will believe that you have come back, and then you'll be admitted back into the church. And so we see, even at this stage, this tendency to get away from an understanding that belief is a matter of the heart, and to try to quantify that, and to try to understand that based on people's external activities, external behaviors. So you see, even with that struggle, the beginning of something that was going to plague the church for many years after that. Well, let me just close with one thing I wanted to read to you. And this goes back to the whole picture of the persecution that was going on in the church. I'm going to read just a short section from a book called Fox's Book of Martyrs. If you lived in the 16th or 17th century in England, Fox's Book of Martyrs was in everyone's home during those years. It was one of the most well-read, one of the most popular Christian books of the time. And it's just an accounting of church history from the perspective of looking at those who have been martyred throughout church history. So I'm just going to read a little bit of an account of what was going on with Christians, specifically in Rome in the early part of the early years of the church in the latter half of the first century. And Fox has this to say about what was going on in Rome. He says, "It has been said that the lives of the early Christians consisted in, quote, persecution above ground and prayer below ground, end quote. Their lives are expressed by the Colosseum and by the catacombs. Beneath Rome are the excavations which we call the catacombs, which were at once temples and tombs. The early church of Rome might well be called the Church of the Catacombs. There are some 60 catacombs near Rome in which some 600 miles of galleries have been traced, and these are not all. These galleries are about 8 feet high and from 3 to 5 feet wide, containing on either side several rows of long, low horizontal recesses, one above another like berths in a ship. In these the dead bodies were placed and the front closed, either by a single marble slab or several great tiles laid in mortar. On these slabs or tiles, epitaphs or symbols are graved or painted. Both pagans and Christians buried their dead in these catacombs. When the Christian graves have been opened, the skeletons tell their own terrible tale. Heads are found severed from the body, ribs and shoulder blades are broken, bones are often calcined from fire. But despite the awful story of persecution that we may read here, the inscriptions breathe forth peace and joy and triumph. Here are a few inscriptions. Here lies Marcia, put to rest in a dream of peace." And as I read these, let me just make this comment. When we read these in 21st century America in the church, these sound sappy, sentimental, silly. These are people who were forced to decide whether it was worth their life to believe in the gospel or not. We don't have to do that. I mean, we've never faced anything like that. These are people for whom it was a matter of life or death whether they were going to believe in the gospel. So a few more. "Lawrence to his sweetest son, born away of angels." And another one, "Victorious in peace and in Christ." Another one, "Being called away, he went in peace." And then Fox goes on and he says, "Remember when reading these inscriptions, the story the skeletons tell of persecution, of torture, and of fire. But the full force of these epitaphs is seen when we contrast them with the pagan epitaphs of graves nearby, such as, 'Live for the present hour, since we are sure of nothing else.' Or another one, 'I lift my hands against the gods who took me away at the age of 20, though I had done no harm.' Another one, 'Once I was not, now I am not. I know nothing about it, and it is no concern of mine.' Another one, Traveler, curse me not as you pass, for I am in darkness and cannot answer." And then Fox concludes this section by saying, the most frequent Christian symbols on the walls of the catacombs are the Good Shepherd with the Lamb on his shoulder, a ship under full sail, harps, anchors, crowns, vines, and above all, the fish." Well, again, in our context, sitting here in Coburg, Oregon in 2009, that all sounds so far away. But there have been times in the history of the church, there are places in the world today in the church where it is not safe to be a believer, where it is not safe to be a man or woman of faith. And I would suggest that those are the times, and let me broaden that, I guess, a little bit by saying there are times in our lives as individuals where we have to come to grips with how seriously we take belief. There are times that we have to come to grips with those things because of disappointments we face in life or because of things that have happened to us personally, perhaps. So I don't want to minimize that. I don't want to say that we in this situation don't ever run into those struggles, because we do. But in the church, in the history of the church, it was a different setting when the very fact that they believed would raise the specter of persecution and of death for them. So that's all I have to say for this morning. Next week we're going to talk a little bit about some of the theological controversies in the first three centuries. Any questions before we knock off for the morning? Wow. David?
Thanks, Peter.
Sure.
Going way back to your third opening point, you said something to the effect of truth is often sacrificed to promote the harmony of the group. Mm-hmm. And I'd just like you to, do you have an example of that you could share?
Well, yeah, I guess the examples are almost too myriad to share, but I'll use a possible example. If everybody in this room was forced to adhere to the same finely tuned, detailed doctrinal statement, then for probably most of us, we would have to cross our own conscience in adhering to things that we don't necessarily believe are true. And that's the point that I was trying to get at there. And you see it in larger and smaller ways throughout the history of the church, that when doctrinal truth is narrowly and in detail defined, and one is required to adhere to that narrow definition in order to be a part of the church or in order to be a part of the community, well, then chances are truth is sacrificed in the process. So I don't know if that helps or not, but that's, and we'll see that much more both next week and then sometime in the future when we get into the Middle Ages particularly, and what went on in the church in the Middle Ages, where they got way off track and where true believers were the ones who were being persecuted and martyred by the church. We'll see that much more clearly during those times.
Bob. Thank you, Peter. That's very interesting. Are you going to talk at all about the canonization of Scripture. To me, that's a huge question when I think about church history. I mean, we just take for granted this is our Bible. They didn't have it that simple. It wasn't that straightforward. Are you going to at any point talk about how the Scripture came to be recognized as Scripture and what the issues were and how they resolved those issues?
It would really be hard to avoid that now, wouldn't it?
Oh, you can avoid it.
I had not planned to. That wasn't something I was going to spend a lot of time on, but let me see if I can address it somewhat this next week. Anybody else? Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you all, and see you next week.